You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Pollan has written about how food is grown, how our whole food system has changed with industrialization, what foods we should be eating, and now he's turned to its preparation. In Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, he describes how he learned the roles of the four classical elements, fire, water, air, and earth, in changing the stuff of nature into what we eat and drink. And as a result, he masters barbecue, braising, baking bread, and fermentation, and makes the case that by cooking more at home, we can help make the American food system healthier and more sustainable. This new book, his seventh, is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Pollan back to our show today. Hello.
Thanks, Leonard. Good to be back.
You write that cooking is the answer to many questions you had. What were some of the questions?
Well, the kinds of questions I had were like, what should you do about your health if you're concerned about your diet? And I've spent a lot of time in previous books studying nutrition science and learning that, in fact, nutrients really don't explain things very well. And one of the things I learned was that if your food is cooked by human beings rather than corporations, the health issues just kind of take care of themselves. You will automatically eat what you should be eating, and you can stop worrying about nutrients. So that was one question. And another was, you know, kind of how to connect to my teenage son. I had a 16-year-old at the time, and you know, teenagers are best dealt with not face-to-face, with direct eye contact, usually while you do something, either driving or some activity. And we found that cooking together was a wonderful way to spend time together.
Despite the popularity of cooking shows and the fact that certain chefs have become household names and there's a growing interest in food issues, you seem to be suggesting that people have lost interest and lost the ability to cook. Why do you think that is?
Well, home cooking is in decline. It's fallen. The amount of time we spend cooking and the number of meals that are home cooked has fallen by about half since 1970. And the irony or the paradox is that we seem obsessed with cooking as a culture, and that we watch cooking shows on television. And in fact, the average American only spends about 27 minutes a day cooking now. It used to be an hour. So that means there are millions of people spending more time watching cooking on TV than actually cooking themselves.
Preparing for the future when they may cook.
Yeah, except I don't think that those shows really empower you to cook. I think they terrify you. You know, you have these fountains of flames and flying knives and a clock counting down the seconds. I don't know about you, but that doesn't encourage me to get in the kitchen.
Well, the other kinds of cooking shows, Julia Childs, and now more recently people like Lydia Bastianich,
Those
popular
do.
As well, and they're yeah. all about learning, you know, the logic of logical progression of preparing a meal.
Yeah, the daytime shows are actually more empowering. They really will give you some information. The night shows that are designed as game shows, in effect, or spectacle, or sports,
reality
competitive
shows.
Sports. Yeah, the reality shows. They're the ones that I think are actually discouraging people.
What was your level of culinary expertise and your interest in everyday cooking before you began this project?
I was a cook. It wasn't as if I didn't cook at all, but I did it without a lot of thought or without a lot of skill. I mean, I could get dinner on the table, and we would cook more nights than not, but I would throw fillets of this or that on the grill, and I live in California, so we can grill 12 months of the year. And so it was very unambitious and not very thoughtful.
And what got you thinking about applying the four elements, fire, water, air, earth, to an approach to cooking?
Well, I have to thank my wife, Judith, for that. That was her insight when I was trying to structure the book. She said, hey, what you're describing really sounds a lot like the four elements, which was curious, and I can't explain exactly why it works. But what I wanted to do in this book was drive cooking, you know, into a corner and get back to the basics and see and remove this crust of pretension and professionalization and, like, what are the elements of it? In the same way I'd done that with, you know, gardening and architecture in previous books. And what were the basics? What was the common denominator? And I realized there were these basic transformations. Fire was one, cooking with fire, obviously, the
Which
oldest.
Which was probably the the most common. I mean, yeah. almost all cooking is done with fire.
Yeah, every culture has cooked with fire. We figured it out. It may have been 2 million years ago, which is before we were actually Homo sapiens. We were Homo erectus.
Well, Prometheus did it, right?
Yeah, that's right. Prometheus did it, and it's a founding myth. And in fact, Prometheus's fire in one version is a cook fire specifically, and that's cooking, primordial cooking. Cooking with water, which is to say in pots, happens much, much later, about 10,000 years ago, because we needed the technology of clay, fired clay, that could withstand being on a fire. And that opened up a whole new horizon, because once you can cook with water, you can soften grain, you can mix vegetables with meat, you can make stews, you lose none of the nutrients. Whereas if you're cooking meat over fire, you lose a lot of nutrients in the fire, and they drip off. The other great thing about cooking with water and why that was such an important breakthrough is it allows you to keep old people alive once they lose their teeth. In the old days, when they lost their teeth, they couldn't eat. And it also allows you to wean babies really early, which is interesting. So it changed human civilization in many, many ways. And then air was baking. You know, we have all these foods where our goal is to inject air into them to elevate them. And there's also, you know, soufflés and sparkling wine and all this kind of stuff. But I focused on baking. And then earth.
And when does that come into human history?
It's about 6,000 years ago. Before that, we would eat grain as a porridge. We would, you know, put it in water, let it sit, and somebody, probably in Egypt, was watching a pile of mush and noticed it had suddenly started to be alive. And some air had come into it, and it was bubbling. And I guess put it on a fire and found this amazing multiplication.
And that was pita, probably, something like that.
It was probably a pita bread, yeah, the early ones. But that technology was revolutionary because although you can, you can't survive on flour. If you had a diet of flour, you would die eventually. You can survive on the bread baked from that flour. And the reason for that is that the baking process, especially with a sourdough starter, breaks down the seeds, releases all the minerals and other nutrients in it. And then the loaf itself is a pressure cooker that allows you to get the temperature up above boiling, because what's happening in all the pockets of a bread is you're steaming it. And that further breaks down the starches into a very digestible form.
Same thing happened with tortillas. Took corn and gave it all sorts of extra nutritional value.
Right. And also the adding of the lime made it a complete protein.
And then the last one is... Have we covered them all?
Earth. No, earth. Well, earth is kind of
cook
the most...
Cook with dirt?
Well, it's a little bit metaphoric. I mean, the earth is a hotbed of bacteria and microbes and fungus. And so earth cooking is fermentation. It's cooking without the use of fire, strictly with biology, with microbes. And for me, that was, in many ways, the most fascinating of all, because I knew the least about it.
And that's what leads to food preservation, doesn't it?
Yeah. We find in history all cultures have used some form of fermentation to preserve food. In the days before refrigeration, that was it. You could dry things. You could make beef jerky and dry various other plants and things. But fermentation was the way you could take food. You would dig a pit, essentially. You would actually ferment in the earth. Kimchi is fermented in the earth. In Iceland, they still ferment fish in the earth. They bury these awful-tasting sharks, and they ferment them for 6 months, and then they claim to think it's a delicacy.
Although come up with what some people think is still awful-tasting food. But
yeah.
Icelanders like it.
Well, you know, it's one of the interesting things about fermented food is every culture seems to have a ferment that they love that disgusts people in another culture. So that if you take if you take cheese to China, they're absolutely disgusted by even a mild cheese. It's just too stinky. Yet they love stinky tofu, which is rotten tofu.
My guest is Michael Pollan, whose latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. For fire, you went to North Carolina to learn about barbecue. Now, you could have done a lot of different things with fire.
Yeah, I could have. And I tried a lot of different avenues, and I looked at fire in Argentina, in fact, and I do go to Spain to look at an amazing grill master there.
So this was an opportunity for you to travel as well and blame it on a book.
Such a sweet gig. I mean, I've never had so much fun reporting, so-called. I put it in quotes. I was getting paid to learn how to do these things and hang out with these amazing characters. But for barbecue, I wanted something that was really elemental and primal, and that was whole hog barbecue. Which is eastern North Carolina. You know, the South is divided up. It's balkanized into these little republics of barbecue. It's like Yugoslavia. I mean, and so at a certain dividing line in North Carolina, they're doing shoulders with a sauce that has tomatoes in it. East of that line, they're doing whole hog exclusively with vinegar-based sauce. And that's what drew me. I liked the taste of it, but I also liked how fundamental it was, you know, a whole animal over a fire. And it looked a lot like ritual sacrifice.
So that. North Carolina is where you went.
Eastern North Carolina. I went to Wilson and Durham, and I worked with an amazing pit master who actually comes to New York for the barbecue black party every year, Ed Mitchell.
In June.
Yes, and if you want to try his sandwiches, they're amazing. He's a great barbecue master.
Well, Jeff at Starlight talked about how pigs today don't create as much dripping lard as they used to. That's because they're being bred to be leaner than they were in the past?
Yeah. I mean, we kind of screwed up the pig back in the 60s and 70s for a couple of reasons. We moved them indoors, and we started growing confinement hogs and in this really brutal agriculture. And but at the same time, you know, there was the panic over fat. We were a lipophobic culture. And so pork was trying to compete with beef and chicken. Remember the new white meat? And the way they did this was they basically bred the fat out of these animals, which is to the great detriment of barbecue.
Well, there were some people who are going back to heritage pigs, aren't there?
And Ed Mitchell is one of them. The pit master I worked with has made a practice of buying his pigs from small farmers using heritage breeds and growing them the old-fashioned way outdoors. And that's one of the reasons I was drawn to him, because a lot of pit masters are not paying attention to the whole food chain. They're really just using commodity pork. And I understand that, the economics of it. If you want to sell a sandwich for less than a Big Mac, which they do, you're going to have to use commodity pork. But Ed Mitchell is doing something a little different and getting his price.
Frank Bruni had an op-ed piece in today's New York Times about the growing problem of feral hogs in Texas. Couldn't we just
California, too.
So couldn't we just catch some of them and solve a couple of problems all at the same time?
Well, you're going to have to talk to the USDA about that. It's a terrific idea, but it's illegal to sell game in restaurants and sell it in commerce. You can do it for yourself. But the deer problem, the feral pig problem, you know, we talk about our desire for sustainable meat. Well, it's all around us, and we're not allowed to have it in commerce. I kind of understand the reasons. There are some issues with wasting disease in some ruminant populations. But it seems to me you could test for that, and that there is enormous potential to feed us meat without doing the damage to the environment that's happening.
You look in this book at the cooking hypothesis. Can you explain it? We had Richard Wrangham as a guest on our show in September 2009 to talk about his book called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human.
Well, Richard was a source in this book, and I spent a lot of time reading his work and interviewing him for it. And he has a very intriguing theory that when we controlled fire, which happens about 2 million years ago by his estimate, that is that moment, that quantum leap in the size of the human brain, which is accompanied by a shrinking of the human gut. There's kind of a evolutionary trade-off. You either have a big brain or a big gut. If you think of the cow, you know, it's got the big, very, very clever gut, but not a very clever brain. And this changed us, and it directed our evolution down this path. And the reason for that is that when you start cooking food, you start breaking it down outside the body. It's essentially an externalized form of digestion. So the food doesn't have to be chewed as much, and your body doesn't have to have an elaborate digestive apparatus to break it down. And this frees up lots of energy for the growth of the human brain. And one of the things that Wrangham, who's also a primatologist, by the way, not just an anthropologist, discovered is that apes our size spend, who have to need as much energy as we do, spent 6 hours a day in the mere act of chewing. Now, if we were chewing 6 hours a day, we would not have radio. We would not have art. We would not have opera.
Well, Henry James felt that we should chew everything, I think it was 100 times.
Yeah. And, you know, we should chew more than we do. But 6 hours, I'm really happy we don't have to do that. And we have cooking to thank. It also implies that a raw food diet is fundamentally not, we're not well adapted to a raw food diet.
And Wrangham said also that meat was important to human evolution, which should upset some vegetarians. But why do you think the trend in recent years has been toward vegetarianism?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, a lot of very good reasons to be a vegetarian. I mean, for one thing, vegetarians are healthier than meat eaters, than heavy meat eaters. Meat eaters.
So this came after evolution, after humans developed into what they are today?
No, we don't know how much meat we were eating when we were this, you know, big carnivore. It may not have been a daily thing. We were still eating a lot of plants. So those carnivores were probably much more, they were really omnivores. We can survive just fine on vegetables. Some people do better than others, but you can find all the proteins you need by mixing up your vegetables. So we're not entirely bound by our evolution. There's lots of things that we don't do anymore. We can overcome it in various ways. For example, raw food or foodists overcome this problem with the blender. Right. I mean, they let this Cuisinart do all their chewing for them, essentially, so they don't have to spend 6 hours a day chewing.
My guest is Michael Pollan. His six previous books include Food Rules, In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, which were all New York Times bestsellers. His latest is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, published by Penguin Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Michael Pollan, whose latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. It's published by Penguin Press. So let's talk a bit about your apprenticeship as a pit master.
Well, I went down to Eastern North Carolina, and I found this guy, Ed Mitchell. And he's a character. He's a really larger-than-life character. He'd been a Vietnam vet, grew up poor. His grandparents were sharecroppers. He's African-American. And then he worked for a Ford dealership. There was a minority dealership program after that. And his parents owned a little grocery store in Wilson. And when his dad died, he came back to Wilson to help his mom out. And business started kind of falling apart. And his mom was really depressed. And he came by one day and she said, "I only made $14 today, and it was all in food stamps." And to cheer her up, he said, "Let's have a little barbecue." So he went down to the store at the Piggly Wiggly and got a little like 35-pound pig, which you could do in that town. And he slow cooked it, and he chopped it up and made his mom this barbecue. And a customer came in and said, "You selling barbecue now?" And his mom looked at Ed and said, "Is this okay?" And he said, "Yeah, sell the man some barbecue." Sells him some barbecue, and he took a couple sandwiches, and word got around town that day that this was really good barbecue. And he found his calling, and he became a pit master and began selling barbecue in Wilson, North Carolina.
So it's possible to duplicate wood fire whole hog barbecue in your home?
I do it now in my front yard once a year. Yeah, I have an annual pig roast.
So you need special equipment?
No. I have a fire pit. I just have this big metal pit about 4 foot in diameter. And you have to trick things up, and I put a grate over that. I buy a pig from a local farmer. They're happy to sell them to you. It's remarkably inexpensive, given how many people. You can feed 50 people for like $150. And then I make a kind of tent over it to hold the heat in. I make a wood fire. And the challenge is keeping the temperature low. You really don't want to go over 200 degrees because you're going to cook for 20 hours. The other challenge is finding some young people willing to stay up all night. And with a bottle of bourbon and a poker game, you can arrange that if you have a college-age son. And so we do this. Jack Hitt, the writer, taught me how to do this in the home. And he's a wonderful pit master. And he also can stay up all night if you give him enough espressos. And so we do this every year, and it's a wonderful event. And this thing, you know, goes from being this kind of scary dead animal to this beautifully lacquered pig with this gorgeous crackling on it.
Well, then you have to pull off the meat off the bone. You have to chop it up.
It's not that hard, though, especially if you have the right tool. There's something you can get online called bear claws, which is these plastic extenders, and you put them on like brass knuckles, and it makes your fist look like bear claws, and you can take apart a pig in about a half hour.
And what about seasoning?
Well,
because you put the whole pig in.
That's right. All you've done is salted it so far, and it's very simple. And then once you chop it up, you mix in apple cider vinegar, some sugar, some salt, and red pepper flakes. And you're chopping it and you're mixing it. And then the key to Eastern North Carolina barbecue that makes it really special is they take the skin off and then cook that separately to crisp it up. It's very difficult to do because you've got to take it right to the point where it's about to burn but not let it burn. And it turns to glass at a certain moment. You pull it off, let it cool, and then take a knife and chop it up. And it just falls apart like glass.
And that's crackling.
Crackling. And you mix that in. And the beautiful thing about whole hog barbecue is all the different cuts are combined. It's very democratic in that sense. So the good cuts and the bad cuts and the moist ones and the dry ones. And then you make a sandwich.
Well, not everyone can eat pig. Jews and Muslims do not eat pig. Can you do something similar with, well, a cow would be so large.
Yeah, that would be difficult. Yeah, you can. You can cook a lamb this way. You can cook a goat this way. Is goat kosher? I think goat is
yes.
kosher. Yeah. I just gave a little sermon at Central Synagogue about kosher and talked a lot about barbecue. And because one of the things that really struck me about barbecue is how many rules they have about barbecue. It's very much like Leviticus. And there's something about rule making and meat eating that seems to go together. And I think we need to rethink the kosher rules. And I think there is a place for pork in the kosher rules. And I know that that's possibly an upsetting argument to make. But to the extent that the kosher rules are about eating ethically, I think eating pig can be a very ethical kind of eating.
Only 2,000 or 3,000 years of tradition out the, the window, but okay.
And I need to acknowledge the importance of that. I'm of two minds. The fact is that rules around food are not rational. They're about knitting a culture together.
But that also reminds me of all sorts of conventional wisdoms in cooking that turn out not always to be true.
Yeah.
You know, there are these old, almost old wives' rules. You got to braise this thing or you got to do something else before you go to the next step, and it doesn't always work out
or
that
searing,
way.
Or searing meat especially. Over a fire to lock in the juices, which yeah. Harold McGee has deconstructed pretty effectively. And the reason I was told that Jews can't eat pork is trichinosis, and which is really not a problem.
My guest is Michael Pollan. His latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. For water, you learned all about braising. What is the basic recipe for braising?
Well, the basic recipe for braising is one of the great recipes to learn because you can apply it to hundreds of dishes. Basically, all you do is brown your meat, if you're going to use meat. You brown your meat, put it aside, chop up some onions, and if you want, make a real mirepoix and have some celery and carrots. Saute that for as long as you can stand to. The longer you do it, the better the dish will be. So not 20 minutes, 40 minutes would be great at a low temperature. Then put the meat back in. And add your liquid, whatever your liquid is. You can use wine, you can use water, you can use in one dish milk, you can use vinegar, and fill it only about halfway through to the height of the meat. The point about a braise is that the top of it is browning because it's exposed to air. The bottom is stewing.
And you're cooking it all in one pot.
And you're cooking it all in one pot, so it's a very efficient dish that way. And then put it in the oven. And one of the big misconceptions about braising. You'll see recipes that say braise at 325 or 300. That's too hot. That's not really a braise. You want to do it around 225, 250. You want it just to be barely bubbling.
Now, you mentioned a mirepoix, which is a way of cooking onions. There's also Italian sofrito.
Sofrito.
How different are they?
Well, these are very interesting phenomenon that all these different traditions have their base. for dishes. Onions are almost universal, and that's interesting in and of itself. And there are a lot of reasons for that. It increases the umami taste of a dish as it breaks down. It adds sweetness. And it also is antimicrobial. It's probably a safety issue. And then the variations are whether you're going to do green pepper, tomato, garlic, celery. And these flavors, though, mark these cuisines. You can tell you're in Spain because you're getting their sofrito versus Italy versus France. And they're not, there's nothing mysterious about them. It just means a lot of chopping.
The chef that you sought out for this look at braising, his name is Samin. She said you have to use a lot of salt. Doesn't that make the meats too salty?
No. One of the things I learned about from her, especially about cooking meat, is that first you should use a generous amount of salt. And all chefs will scare you if you watch them salt. In fact, one great chef I know says you should use 5 times as much salt as you think is reasonable.
That may explain why some of the food I've had in restaurants
is so salty.
Was so salty.
Yes. But basically the key is if you salt far enough in advance, 24, even 48 hours, what happens is that initially the salt draws the liquid out of the meat, out of the cells. But then after that, it creates a vacuum, and then it draws the salty water with whatever other spices are there back into the cells. So you actually get a lot of flavor without a lot of saltiness.
You use a stock usually.
Often, yeah.
And what makes dashi, the Japanese stock, so flavorful?
Dashi is an amazing substance. I call it magic water, and that was one of the things I learned in the course of my education. It's the basic Japanese stock, and it's a really weird thing when you think about it. You start with kombu, which is air-dried kelp. And you basically soak that in some cold water, bring it to a boil. Right before it boils, you pull that out. You take a piece that's about 6 inches by 8 inches or something like that. Then you add bonito flakes, katsuobushi it's called. This bonito has already been smoked, cooked, inoculated with a fungus. It's a very complex process, but you can just buy the flakes in little bags at Sunrise Market or somewhere like that. And then you boil it for 2 minutes. Take that out, pass it through a cheesecloth, and then you can throw in a dried mushroom, a shiitake mushroom. Each of those three ingredients has a different amino acid, guanosate, inosinate, and glutamate in the kombu. And the combination of them has this incredible synergy. And this liquid, which really just kind of smells like seawater, essentially, inflects the taste of anything you cook it with. And it's remarkable. And what it does is give the taste of umami, which is the taste of savoriness.
Now, you also experimented with a microwave meal at your house. A lot of serious cooks hate the idea of doing anything in a microwave other than perhaps melting butter.
Yes, or reheating coffee. I think that's all we should use them for. Or, frozen spinach or something like that, defrosting. I did this as an experiment. I mean, the background of this book is this large question of our health and our lifestyle. And when corporations cook for us, all sorts of problems follow. Corporations don't cook very well. And I wanted to see if convenience food was really so convenient. So we had this microwave meal where everyone in the family went to the supermarket together, and we each got whatever home meal replacement we wanted. I got a curry. My son got both French onion soup and hoisin beef in a little frozen bag, and my wife got lasagna. And we cooked them in the microwave and thinking, well, how much time will we save and how will it actually taste and what kind of meal will it be? And the surprise was that it took 40 minutes to get this meal on the table. And the reason is that the microwave is a severely individualistic technology. You can only do one at a time. And so by the time the fourth entree came out, the first one was cold and had to be nuked again. And we couldn't all eat at the same time because my son got impatient and he just started eating. And we had the most disjointed family meal we've ever had.
Well, Barbara Kafka said that microwaving is good for anything that is steamed. You can steam fish and things like that.
Yeah.
But the kind of meal you're talking about.
I'm not cooking. No,
you're starting with bad ingredients to begin with.
Yeah.
Bread is what you did with air. Because bread starts off with yeast, and you can actually start off with the yeast that's in this room right now?
Yeah. If we had flour and water here, we could mix up a paste. And if we exposed that paste to air for a while, and to our hands probably, and gave it some, just kind of mixed it up every day, within a few days, it would start to bubble. And it would turn into a culture, a sourdough culture. And it's not very hard to do. And you can, and then if you have that, you don't need yeast.
But what happens if you add a little bit of the commercial yeast to that? Does that make it bubble even more?
It could, but, you know, commercial yeast doesn't like sourdough microbes. It's a kind of like a racehorse. It's a thoroughbred that only likes its own to be by itself. It's a loner. It's a monoculture. And a sourdough starter is a polyculture of bacteria and yeast that imparts much more interesting flavor to bread.
And it also gives us the air pockets in bread.
They both will give us air pockets.
And you talk about...
And bread is 80% air.
And you suggest baking bread in a Dutch oven.
Yeah, that's a breakthrough for home bread bakers. Jim Leahy talks about this, and Chad Robertson, who I studied with, talks about this. But basically, if you use a Dutch oven, and you can use a Creuset casserole, if you bake in that, you create that steamy, closed environment that a professional baking oven has. Our home ovens are designed to vent steam, but you want steam. The steam is what keeps the crust from forming too fast and allows it to keep growing. It keeps it elastic. So the first 20 minutes you do in this closed environment, and you don't have to add steam. There's enough in the bread itself. Take off the top, and you will see this gorgeous kind of fawn-colored pillow, and then give it another 25 minutes in the open oven, and then you have the best crust you're going to get at home.
We don't have a lot of time. I'm not even going to get to the fermentation, but let's talk about flour for a moment, the flour that we get in the supermarket. It has really been processed, refined a lot. Does it have any nutritional value?
Well, you know, white flour, you're talking about white flour, is nutritionally kind of worthless. It's mostly glucose, but it's been fortified.
In the middle of the 20th century, there was this whole, or even earlier, there was this white food movement. Is that what happened with the flour?
Well, what happened with flour is there was always a lot of prestige attached to the whitest possible bread. And only the rich could afford white bread because they could afford to have it sifted for them. But then in the 1880s, we came up with this roller mill technology, which allowed us to completely remove the germ and the bran, which happened to be the healthiest, most flavorful parts of the wheat, and get rid of them. Industry loved this because it stabilized the product. It was shelf stable, and the germ is prone to go rancid if you don't use it quickly. So this is the case where this whole glorious tradition of processing food to make it more nutritious stops. And suddenly we're processing food in the modern sense to make it less healthy. And as soon as we moved to white flour, we had an epidemic of nutritional deficiency. People didn't know why, but then they figured out, oh, we took out all the vitamins. So then we had Wonder Bread. We had the quiet...
You went to the plant, didn't
you? I watched them bake Wonder Bread. It was an amazing process. So they add back in the nutrients. It seems to me it's a classic case of capitalism. Instead of going back to fix a problem it created, it had this Band-Aid. So they were able to sell the problem and the solution in one neat package, fortified white flour.
Just one more thing. We have talked a lot on the show in the past about raw milk cheeses. You also studied with a nun, Sister Noella, who taught you about how to make cheese
and raw milk cheeses.
Raw milk cheeses.
Fact, yeah.
There has been a trend in recent years of governments banning it or restricting raw milk cheeses. What's the problem there?
Well, the problem is that, a lot of bacteria likes to grow in milk. And if you know what you're doing, raw milk cheese is perfectly safe. There are a lot of people who don't always know what they're doing. The other problem is that this kind of food with lots of bacteria in it, such as raw milk and raw milk cheese, our bodies are, you could say that was our grandfather's food, and that's true, but we don't have our grandfather's immune system anymore. So there are people whose immune systems are compromised, and that they may have trouble with some of the bacteria you find in that. Raw milk creates beautiful flavors in cheese. The bacteria in the milk is the reason. The bacteria is by and large a positive. The laws governing raw milk cheese really aren't rational. I mean, we basically say if it's aged for 2 months, it's safe. And that isn't necessarily true. There are younger ones that are perfectly safe. There are older ones that are not safe. And I don't know what the government's ultimately going to do with raw milk cheese. It would be an enormous loss to ban it. But there is a chance that they will do that.
Well, I'm willing to take the chance. And I've been eating raw milk cheeses all my life. And I'm still here.
Yeah, well, and I take the chance too. And I think one of the things I do in the fermentation section is look at the health of the gut. And the fact is, if you have a healthy gut, things that make other people sick are not going to make you sick.
Michael Pollan's latest book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, pleasure, Leonard.